did by our Chicago Police Department and others, as you know, in the press repeatedly. And those of us on the logistics committee for the next week's march take this very seriously, that we do have a responsibility to our fellow protesters and to our fellow residents of the city of Chicago to do what we can to make sure that things remain nonviolent and peaceful, that everyone can feel like they can participate in Sunday's march. But we need your help in order to do this. We have organized a pair of so-called peace guide training sessions. For one of them is Monday night, and the other is the Saturday just before the Sunday march. We are asking all of those in town who can possibly make themselves available to participate in a peace guide training to attend the session on Monday night. It's 6:30 to 9 p.m. At the Trinity Episcopalian Church, which is just, you know, shadowed by the summit here over at 26 in California, 26 in Michigan. That was a Freudian slip. Seriously, this is, we are not having so-called parade marshals. You just put on an armband and you just go and it's all loosey-goosey. This is going to be role-playing. It's going to be laying out detailed plans for how we are going to make sure that this march is peaceful, that everyone feels that they can participate. In order to be a peace guide on Sunday, May 20th, it is required that you attend one of these training sessions. And we would like all those who are going to be attending to pre-register with us. And so I'm going to be sending around a clipboard here. We need your name, we need your cell phone number if you have a cell, and your email address. And we will contact you, just a reminder about the Monday night Peace Guides training. But this is very, very important. As I said, the other side has been relentless in their baiting of us, and that makes it that much more incumbent upon us to make sure that our march focuses on the message of opposing NATO's violence and that we respect the IVAW veterans who will be leading that march. So please make the time to not only participate on May 20th, but actually help the coalition out so that we can have the event that all of us are intending to have. Thank you very much.
All right. So welcome, everybody, to the second day of the People's Summit. And and a happy Mother's Day to all the mothers and the children of mothers in the audiences. And very inclusive. We're up to 100% now. So I have a few announcements before we kind of kick off this keynote session. And again, all events today are taking place on the 5th and the 7th floors. Please use the stairs if you're able, as the elevators can't accommodate all who will be coming to the summit. Again, porta-potties are located right down from registration on the first floor outside. Occupy Chicago also has, within this building, a ban on drugs and alcohol, so we hope that you respect that ban. We also wanted to make you aware of our safe spaces protocol. We welcome all who have been unprotected and criminalized by the 1%, including prisoners, immigrants, documented or undocumented, precarious laborers, the homeless, LGBTQ community, the unemployed, all others, and thus we will not condemn anyone who suppresses such equality. And we stand for the equality and the liberation of all of the 99%. So please respect that as well. Breakfast and lunch are provided for free by Food Not NATO. That's downstairs. In room 509. And next door, across the way, in 511, there will be tabling as well. So please visit those. The other announcements are, of course, The People's Summit Organizing Group will be meeting in room 715 during lunch. There will be a meeting in here from about 1:30 to 1:02 for international interest groups to communicate with each other, swap contact information, and help to build solidarity from 1:30 to 2 in this room, 709. And lastly, there's a CanGate meeting following the entire day at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the room information. It will be told to you during our last plenary panel. So, in honor of Mother's Day, I wanted to read to you a short clip from a proclamation in 1870 by Julia Ward Howe, who intended to develop Mother's Day into an anti-war holiday. She says, "We will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us, reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have taught them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender to those of another who allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs." So. Similarly, along the ideas of solidarity and injustice for one is an injustice to all. There's a short poem by George Oppen, who is an activist in his own right. This poem was written for a series called Of Being Numerous in 1968, and it says, "Obsessed, bewildered by the shipwreck of the singular, we have chosen the meaning of being numerous." So, with that said, I want to welcome everyone to our first plenary panel of the day. An injury to one is an injury to all. Fighting oppression to unite the 99%. We have some amazing panelists here. To my left is Soraya Sahar. And to her left is Anton Ford. To my right, Jorge Mujica. And to his right, Jan Rodolfo. We'll be opening the panel with Soraya Sahar. She is a founding member of Afghans for Peace, an alliance of Afghans from various ethnic, religious, socioeconomic, cultural, and political backgrounds with a united vision for a democratic, all-inclusive, just, and peaceful Afghanistan. Based in Toronto, she has spoken at anti-war events across North America. She will be reading a statement from Malalaya Joya, whose bio I will read to you now, who can't be here with us today due to illness. She has been called the most famous woman in Afghanistan. She grew up in refugee camps in Iran and Pakistan before returning to Afghanistan as a social activist and a teacher at an underground girls' school during the Taliban's reign. In 2005, she was elected to Afghan's parliament, a post from which she was suspended in 2007 for her regular denunciation of the country's warlords and their cronies in government. So join me for a nice warm welcome for Soraya Sahar.
It's actually really unfortunate that Malajai couldn't be here today, but you know, I am honored to be standing here before you today, reading her statement in solidarity as a fellow Afghan in the peace-led movement. Right, it's called the Statement to the Chicago People's Summit Against NATO. To the UNAC Anti-War Coalition and to all the organizations and groups who are working to protest NATO's meeting in Chicago, I send my warmest greetings. Unfortunately, for health reasons, I was unable to make the long journey to you for this People's Summit and next weekend's protest. I wish you great success in your efforts. And for anyone who was able to make it to Chicago, please get there to join this protest. You have a chance to be part of history, because the Chicago protest will be seen as an example to people around the world that there are many peace-loving people in the United States. Here in Afghanistan, your actions inside the United States have enormous moral value. You remind us that the government of the U.S. is not representative of the people of the U.S. That that there are thousands and even millions of people who are willing to take action and stand up against this unjust and disastrous war. Recently, as I'm sure you know, U.S. President Obama traveled... U.S. President Obama traveled to Kabul to meet Afghanistan's so-called President Hamid Karzai. Both leaders use this meeting to pretend that they are ending this war when they are really trying to continue it even longer. Obama knows that the U.S. people are turning against the war. And both men know that the Afghan people are against this war and reject the foreign occupation of their country. So on one hand, they claim the war will end in 2014, while on the other hand, they say that U.S. troops will remain in some capacity until 2024. My friends, when 2024 comes closer, they will say they plan to remain in Afghanistan until 2034. The reality is that the U.S. and their NATO allies plan to dominate Afghanistan and the larger region militarily for the next generation. They need this for the geostrategic reasons. They want to control the energy and mineral resources of our countries. And they want to maintain military superiority against China and other competitors. Do not believe the words of Obama and others who say they are working for peace, even while they continue to make war and to kill our people in bombings, night raids, and now more and more drone attacks that kill civilians every week and sometimes every day. In Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other countries. I know that your protests will likely face repression, but it is important that you continue and that you take to the streets to raise your voice. Here in Afghanistan, many peace and women's rights activists literally risk their lives to hold protests against the occupation and against the fundamentalist warlords. I understand that Chicago is something like President Obama's hometown because he lived there many years, and it was in the state of Illinois where he was first elected. My hometown is in Afghanistan's remote Farah province. I was elected in 2005 when I was only 26 years old to represent Farah province in Afghanistan's parliament. Because I spoke out and denounced the occupation, the warlords, and the Taliban, I faced threats, assassination attempts, and then they even kicked me out of parliament in 2007. Since I was banished, I was unable to stand in parliament and condemn a NATO bombing in May 2009 that killed approximately 150 people in my province of Farah. Most of the victims of this massacre were women and children. If I ever had the chance to meet Obama and his wife, Michelle Obama, I would ask them how they would feel if their daughters were killed in this brutal manner, bombed to pieces from the sky. This is the reality of the war in Afghanistan. This is the reality of what NATO does all around the world. And if NATO is allowed to stay and continue the war in Afghanistan, they will be emboldened to wage more wars against more people in the Middle East, in Africa, and beyond. We have many problems in Afghanistan. Fundamentalism, warlords, the Taliban. But we will have a better chance if we have our self-determination, our freedom, our independence. NATO's bombs will never bring democracy and justice to Afghanistan or any other country. That is my main message. With your protests in Chicago, you will send your own message that you are against the massacres that continue to take place in my crying Afghanistan. Your voices in the streets of Chicago will be seen and heard in Kabul and in Farah and eventually in every corner of Afghanistan, even if the media does not report these events to us fully and properly. As we say in Afghanistan, the truth is like the sun. When it comes out, nothing can block it. I'm sorry I cannot be there with you this week physically, but I and millions of other Afghans are with you in heart and in spirit. On May 20th, peace-loving people in every country of the world will be watching you in Chicago and wishing you solidarity. In the long run, our desire for true justice and democracy will defeat all of NATO's guns and bombs. Long live peace and freedom. From Kabul to Chicago, we say no to NATO.
After such a wonderful statement. So I'll just introduce Anton. So Anton Ford is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago, and he plays a leading role in Chicago in the fight for justice for Trayvon Martin and police murder victims, one of which Eric Reuter mentioned yesterday in his plenary speech, Urikiah Boyd and Stefan Watts. So please welcome Anton Ford.
Good morning. So a few weeks ago, George Zimmerman, the wannabe cop, the wannabe neighborhood vigilante, the good old-fashioned racist vigilante, was arrested and charged with the murder of Trayvon Martin a full 45 days after the crime. The details of the case are well known to everyone here, but they raise two questions. First, what is the real problem, and what is the solution? First, why is it that an innocent black teenager who's doing nothing but minding his own business, walking down the street and talking on the telephone, could appear, or could plausibly appear, somehow suspicious, somehow criminal, such that it might take 45 days to arrest George Zimmerman, despite his having ignored the explicit instructions of law enforcement officials? And second, given that he wasn't arrested immediately, why was he ever arrested? What turned the tide? The second question is a little easier to answer in this case. The local police department in Sanford, Florida, tried to sweep the case under the rug. And the only reason that they didn't succeed in making it go away is that tens of thousands of people protested across the country loudly and visibly and kept pressure on the case. That's the only reason this case didn't disappear. Of course, we know that being arrested and tried is one thing and being convicted is another. The murderers of Emmett Till were tried and they were let off. The people who beat Rodney King were tried and they were let off. The cop who killed Oscar Grant was tried and he was let off with a 2-year sentence, which as of this week he's appealing so that he can seek employment in law enforcement again, and we'll see how that goes. And we'll see whether George Zimmerman gets off, and we'll see what happens if he does. But even to get him arrested, just arrested, took tens of thousands of people protesting in the street. Now, the federal government, the state of Florida, the town of Sanford, the liberal and conservative media, and the self-congratulatory special prosecutor have presented the arrest of George Zimmerman as proof that the criminal justice system works just fine. The special prosecutor was so pleased with herself, so visibly delighted, when she announced that he was going to be arrested, it looked like she was giving out an Oscar. That was her demeanor. It's as though to say, everybody can go home now and be quiet. Stop protesting. The system works. If anything, though, what this case shows is that the system is broken and that protest works. It was protest and not the so-called criminal justice system that brought George Zimmerman to trial. Of course, to say that the system is broken assumes something about what that system is for and what it's up to when it's functioning well, what its purpose is. It assumes that its purpose is to bring criminals to justice rather than to criminalize, dehumanize, and control people of color.
And that's a pretty implausible claim in view of the vastly disproportionate numbers of African Americans and Latinos who are in jail. Half of the prison population is black, while only 13% of the general population is black. In view of that and other things which I'll get to in a moment, it's a little implausible to think that this is what the system is even trying to do. The system that's held in place first by a Democrat, then by a Republican, then by a Democrat, then by a Republican. In the last 30 years, the prison population in this country, that is, since the 1970s, the prison population has increased fivefold. If we wanted to bring it down to the levels, the prison population down to the levels it was in the mid-70s, we'd have to release 4 out of 5 people now in prison. Now, in this context, it's helpful, I think, to talk about the similarities, but also the differences between the old familiar system of Jim Crow and what Michelle Alexander has called the new Jim Crow, the system of mass incarceration that has grown up in these last 30 years. There are lots of differences, but there are many important similarities. One thing that Alexander points out is that there are more African Americans under the control of the state now than there were in 1850 under slavery. Many of the laws that are now used to put people of color behind bars, principally through the war on drugs, don't explicitly mention race. That's why I ask whether the purpose is to catch criminals or to criminalize a group of people. They don't explicitly mention race. They talk about drugs. Of course, most of the people who are in jail, most of the African Americans in jail are in jail on drug charges. 80% of them for petty drug charges. And it's important to keep in mind, though, that many of the laws under the old Jim Crow also didn't mention race. Literacy tests, poll taxes. None of these laws explicitly mention race, but they're applied in a racist way. Likewise with this war on drugs, started by Ronald Reagan, but continued and defended by Bill Clinton and even our current African-American president, Barack Obama. When Reagan instituted the minimum sentencing for crack cocaine at 100 times the minimum sentencing for powder cocaine, that was thought to be pretty horrendous, I think. But it was defended by Bill Clinton when he was in office. I think that's important to remember. And when Barack Obama when Eric Holder under Barack Obama recently had this figure reduced to 18 times for the minimum sentences, this was heralded in some corners as a great victory. But I think it's important to distinguish between what's somewhat less bad and what's still no good. I mean, to paraphrase Malcolm X, if you stick a knife in a man's back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, you don't call that progress. I think it's important also to keep in mind that the suspicion that fell upon Trayvon Martin is a suspicion that falls upon not just African Americans, but Muslims and Latinos in this country as well. Vigilantism is everyone. Keep your eyes, ever since 9/11, we've been told to keep our eyes out. If you see something, say something. Well, that in that kind of environment, an Iraqi immigrant can be beaten to death in her home just a week after Trayvon Martin in Orange County, California. And in that kind of environment, which is brought to bear equally harshly on Latinos throughout this country, whether they've got documents or not, it's no wonder that people are being killed by racist vigilantes along the border. But I want to go back to the case of Trayvon Martin, not because it's special, but because it's perfectly typical. And I think that's important to emphasize. It happens all the time. And this year alone, in the first 4 years of 2012, 29 African Americans were killed by law enforcement and other security officials. That's at a rate of about 2 a week. 2 of those people were killed in Chicago. Stephon Watts, a teenager with autism whose parents had called the police because there was no hospital they could take their child with special needs to. It had recently been closed. They called the police several times before. The police knew their child's name. They'd interacted with him many times. When they called the non-emergency line, and when the police showed up, they told the police, "Everything's fine, we don't need you." But the police insisted on going in and seeing Stefan for themselves. When they saw him, he was scared. He was in his basement. They were upstairs. He had a butter knife in his hand. The reason that they'd had trouble in the first place is because he'd been trying to pick the lock on his father's bedroom door so that he could use the computer that was inside. So he still had the butter knife in his hands. They were upstairs. He was downstairs. And the first cop shot him from upstairs. The second cop shot him after he'd fallen and killed him. These guys have been, their murder of Stefan Watts has been deemed justified by the Calumet police. The second person I want to mention is Rekia Boyd, a 22-year-old woman who had the misfortune of standing in a park in the west side of Chicago when an off-duty police officer pulled up in his private car and started yelling at the people in the park, telling them to quiet down. The night before, he'd been there yelling at them to quiet down too. And asked what he would have to do to get some peace and quiet, whether he'd have to kill someone. Well, this night, the second night when he went there in his car without wearing a uniform and told people to shut up, they told him to take a hike. And he took his gun out, stuck it out the window of his car, and shot into the crowd. And he shot Rekia Boyd in the back of the head. There's no dispute that she was anything but an innocent bystander. No weapon was ever found on anyone. The other person who was shot immediately ran to another police officer, explaining that some crazy person was trying to kill him. Well, the cop who killed Rekia Boyd, the off-duty cop who killed Rekia Boyd, was immediately judged to have acted justifiably by the police department. A couple weeks later, it was in all the local news that a pit bull in a Chicago dog park had killed a little lap dog. This was all over the local news. It became a sensation when it was discovered that the pit bull was owned and had been brought to the park by an off-duty police officer. As soon as this came out, the police department fell over itself to get this guy suspended. And he was suspended and investigated immediately. So, an off-duty police officer whose dog kills another dog is immediately suspended and investigated. An off-duty police officer in the same city, under the same police department, who shoots into a crowd of unarmed people and kills a woman, has his actions called justifiable. I also want to emphasize this is not, of course, just something that happens in Chicago. It happens everywhere. We know about New York's stop and frisk law, the law that allows police officers to stop a person for no other reason than that they look suspicious. In 2011, they stopped almost 700,000 people. 88% of them were totally innocent of any crime, couldn't even be given a ticket. 88%. Of the 700,000, and 87% of the people stopped were black or Latino. Blacks and Latinos were 26 times more likely to be stopped than whites, despite the fact that the whites stopped were twice as likely to have a weapon. Given these facts, we really have to question what this so-called criminal justice system is for. Is it for bringing criminals to justice, or is it for criminalizing a segment of the population and dehumanizing them and controlling them? The control happens not just while the people are in prison, but for the rest of their lives. Once you have a criminal record, you can be legally discriminated against in employment, in housing. You can't vote. You can't serve on a jury. In many places you can vote, not everywhere, but and this is all perfectly legal, as it was under Jim Crow to avoid African Americans the franchise. In Chicago, 80% of the male workforce has a felony record. On any job application, you are asked to check the box whether you have a record. And 80% of the African American male workforce has to check yes. In this is, again, a new phenomenon. In 1985, 469 black men were sent to prison for drug crimes in the Chicago area. By 2005, the number had risen to almost 9,000. That's a 2,000% rise in 20 years. In 1999, which is still a decade ago, 1,000 black men graduated from Illinois State University. In the same year, 7,000 black men were released from the Illinois State Penitentiary for drug offenses alone. So 7-to-1 ratio on graduations and release from prison, state prison on drug charges. I just want to end by saying what it means in this context to say, as the title of the panel does, that an injury to one is an injury to all. First, what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that the problem here is anything but racism. It means that racism is a problem for every ordinary working class person, including working class white people. Racism is good for the rich and powerful, for the 1%, and for those whose bread they butter, for the tiny clique of oligarchs, the super rich, and the legislators they own, and the cops who enforce the legislation and beat down anyone bold enough to protest. Racism is good for them because it divides the rest of us against one another. And those people have an interest in our being divided. But to say that in this context that an injury to one is an injury to all means foremost that the new Jim Crow, and for that matter the new Juan Crow, is not only an injury to black and brown people who are its principal targets. It means that the racist oppression of black and brown people is harmful to all working class people, including working class white people, and that the only way to fight this, because they're very strong, the only way to fight this is a multiracial, grassroots, bottom-up movement. Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment to plug the Chicago Spring. We have an entire week of actions devoted to bringing people out into the streets and developing solidarity in many different areas. You can find all the information at chicagospring.org, and I'll just give you a brief listing of the days involved. Beginning tomorrow, we have Money for Education, Not War, so it's our focus on education. Tuesday is immigration. No human is illegal. Wednesday, foreclosure. Housing is a right. Thursday, environment. Planet over profits. Friday, march for the Robin Hood tax. Saturday, health care. And everyone knows what's going on Sunday, right? We could probably all say it together at this point. Where do we meet? Petrillo Banchel. When do we meet? What for? Protest NATO and cheating. Okay, thank you. And then on 5/21 democracy and 5/23 there's a large march that I believe Dan will tell us a little more about.
Okay.
Oh, the website is chicagospring.org. And you'll find all the information there. Okay. Our next panelist is Jorge Mujica, who is a leader of the March 10th Committee for Immigrant Rights. And he plays a leading role in the immigrant rights movement here in Chicago and nationally. Please welcome Jorge.
Thank you. I wish I played a leading role. I don't think that's the case. Part of what I'm going to talk about is precisely that. Where are we? Where were we? What we did, and where are we today in the immigration movement? And let's talk about a little bit about the Juan Crow laws. Indeed, this society, or at least the 1% in the top, have decided that criminalizing a group of people is a very profitable adventure, particularly if you criminalize a group of workers. It's not the same thing to criminalize just about everybody and a brown kid, for instance, than criminalize a worker, someone that is, you know, producing profits in the workplace. And that's what the immigration movement is all about, I think. Pretty quickly, let me remind you, in December 2005, 59%, according to some poll, 59% of the big American public agreed that the best way to deal with immigrants without papers in the United States was to deport them all. In that context, Jim Sensenbrenner, legislator, congressman from Wisconsin, introduced and passed fast track a bill in the House of Representatives saying basically that all immigrants without proper documentation were federal criminals, as well as anybody who aided them in any way, including the school bus driver or, you know, the nurse or the physician or anybody else. This was a majority-controlled Republican House of Representatives. However, by May 18, 2006, a majority-controlled Republican Senate introduced and passed a bill legalizing or opening the possibility to legalize around 12 million undocumented immigrants. What's the difference? What happened between December 2005 and May 2006? What happened is that by May 2006, 65% of the great American public believed that the best solution to deal with undocumented immigrants was to legalize undocumented immigrants. What made that change possible? Millions of people marching in the streets of the United States. That's what made it possible. As far as I know, no fax campaign, email campaign, and phone call campaign to your congressman is going to do something like that. It was only the power of those millions of people marching in the streets in at least, that we have record of, 509 cities in the United States, including, of course, Chicago, with almost a million people in the streets on May Day 2006. That's what changed a Republican-controlled Congress, you know, to change. That's what changed their minds, you know, from criminalizing to legalizing this group of people. What happened after that? What happened after that is that this so-called immigration movement, which is not, you know, a compact group of anything, is just composed by thousands and thousands of individuals, activists and organizations, community organizations, hometown associations, and mostly nonprofit organizations, decided that instead of keep the public pressure, instead of keep marching, it should be dedicated to elect good Democrats to the House and the Senate. And in November 2006, the Democratic Party won the majority of the House. And then in November 2008, the Democratic Party won the Senate also and the White House. Where are we today? Today we are 1 million undocumented immigrants less than we were in 2006. There were 12 million undocumented immigrants. Of course, nobody knows exactly, but 12 million. Today, there are about between 10.5 and 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. Why? Well, because in the last 3.5 years, 1 million have been deported by the holder of the White House, who decided that legislation to legalize undocumented immigrants needed votes from both sides of the aisle, despite of having the majority of the House and the majority of the Senate. He decided that no immigration legislation should go through without the Republican votes. Therefore, he decided that the best strategy was to get rid of as many undocumented immigrants as possible, to be tough on immigration in order to convince Republicans to vote in favor to legalize undocumented immigrants. You find that logical? I don't. We ask him, you know, we ask Mr. Barack Obama in, it was October 2006, when he as a senator voted in favor of building the wall between Mexico and the United States. And we ask him why. I mean, basic question, because nobody could understand how a Democratic senator from Illinois, you know, would vote in favor of the wall. And he said, because you have to give a little in order to get a little. And we wonder to this day, what little has he gotten? We don't see it anyway. It should be very small because we haven't seen that little anywhere. So, in the period between 2006 and 2012, 164 anti-immigration laws have been approved in cities, townships, counties, municipalities, and states. Everywhere except the federal government. But we have Juan Crow laws that basically say that you are suspicious by color. You're not only suspicious. You're suspicious based in the color of your skin. You're suspicious based in the color of your hair. You're suspicious based on my bad English. For instance, if you don't speak proper English, and I don't know so far who speaks proper English, but if you don't speak it, you know, if you speak with some kind of accent that is not exactly an Arkansas accent, but, you know, more like a Mexican accent, you know what I mean? You speak it like this, you are immediately suspicious in the states of North Carolina, Utah, Arizona, Alabama, Georgia, and, you know, a bunch of other towns and counties and municipalities. Even the immigrant-friendly state of Illinois has approved anti-immigrant legislation, such as not giving any more workers' compensation to some agricultural workers. I don't know if you knew this, but this is like a year-old law that says that if you're an agricultural worker with less than 2 years in the agricultural fields, obviously, you are not entitled to workers' compensation if you get injured in your job. You have to prove, I don't remember exactly, but I think at least 1,000 days working in the agricultural fields in order to be entitled to get workers' compensation. If that's not a discriminatory law, you tell me what is it. You know, it's known everywhere that about 95% of agricultural workers are Latinos, and they are immigrants, mostly, particularly in the state of Illinois. It may be different some other place, but I know that place. Basically, most 95% of agricultural workers in the whole United States are Latinos, mostly immigrants, and a whole lot of them undocumented. Not only that, Illinois approved a very tricky piece of legislation, very interesting, pushed for by Democratic legislator Susana Mendoza, Latina, obviously, is the DUI law. The DUI law establishes that if you drive drunk, but you do have a driver license, then that's a felony. That's a misdemeanor. But if you drive drunk and you do not have a driver license, then that constitutes a felony. Apparently, at least this is Susana Mendoza's today city clerk of the city of Chicago. Susana Mendoza's argument is that this law is dedicated to people who whose driver license have been rescinded, you know, after many violations to the DUI laws. In fact, and in reality, 95% of those caught driving drunk without a driver license are those people who are not entitled to get a driver license because they are undocumented immigrants. And that's the basis to go to county jails. You know, if you commit a misdemeanor, you end up at the police station. They slap your wrist, or they kill you sometimes, you know, but mostly they slap your wrist, and they let you go, and you have, it's a $100 bond until your court hearing day. But if you do not have a driver license, you end up in the county jails. Immigration agents roam freely county jails. And police reports indicate, believe it or not, so far in the city of Chicago, the immigrant-friendly city of Chicago, the police report indicates your place of birth as an indicator. You know, you have three, they say, three identifiers: name, last name, and place of birth. They could ask you for many other things, but they ask you for your place of birth. Therefore, when you arrive at the Cook County, not anymore, but at the county jail, generally speaking, in the state of Illinois, the ICE agents, ICE means Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the ICE agents simply have to take a look at police reports, the arrest reports, and right there it says all these people were born in Mexico, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, or in Pakistan, or in India. It doesn't matter. But your identifier is right there. So it simplifies a lot the work of these ICE agents. Therefore, they put something called an immigration hold on you. Even if the judge says, okay, this is your first offense, you were driving drunk, but you know, nothing happened, and blah, 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 etc. You're free to go, or you have to pay $1,000 fine, and then you can go. The county jail will hold you until immigration agents come by to pick you up. And that's the basis for this 1 million undocumented immigrants deported in the last 4 years. Let me just finish with this. Again, the change between 2005, December, criminalizing immigrants, to May 2006, was public mobilization. I think only public pressure, mobilization, only with public mobilization you can change not politicians' minds, but politicians' actions. And that's exactly what we are trying to do in this movement. On Tuesday, please, everybody, come and join us at 11 a.m. We will be in front of Immigration Court, which is 525 West Van Buren in Chicago, holding the immigration judges responsible for not obeying a memorandum by Barack Obama. After all, this is an election year, and Barack Obama, after deporting 1 million immigrants, has to do something in favor of immigrants. So he decided that no one without a police record should be deported. But the judges are, of course, not responding to that, and they are just deporting everybody. And so we are going to be protesting in front of Immigration Court on Tuesday at 11 a.m. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jorge. Right now, we'd like to thank you all for coming and for sharing your solidarity. Of course, as we've heard, a theme and a current running throughout not only today's plenary, but throughout the entirety of our People's Summit, change requires collective action. It requires mass mobilization. And we're hoping that this has helped to make that more and more a reality within our world. If anyone has the donation buckets, there they are, right there with our lovely flower design. They'll be walking around the room, and feel free to donate whatever you can. And the quote from yesterday, I believe, was, "To each according to his ability," from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, correct? Yes? Okay. So that's it, if you can donate. We relied on several amazing volunteers to put this together, so thanks again to everyone who helped to plan this summit. And before I introduce our last speaker, too, I'd like to let you know a little news clip that Ashley has shared with me. Yesterday in Madrid, for the one-year anniversary of Occupy Madrid, 100,000 people took to the streets and met in Puerta del Sol to protest austerity and just crises within their country, such as a 50% youth unemployment rate. So may we use that as inspiration as well. Okay, and thank you. Our last speaker is Jan Rodolfo. She is the Midwest Director of National Nurses United and has practiced for 12 years as an ecology nurse. She was one of the nurses arrested in October for providing health care in Grant Park as well. So please welcome Jan Rodolfo.
So let me just start by saying that the healthcare industry, and I mean industry, not system, the healthcare industry in the United States is a true abomination that brings untold suffering to millions of Americans every year, without any question, that prioritizes money over providing healthcare time and time again in every opportunity it gets. I hate dry healthcare trend stats. I'm going to throw a couple out anyway, but then I want to transition into what we actually see at the bedside, which I think is. But in the context of the fact that we're supposed to believe we've already won healthcare reform, right? Oh, success. Oh no, they might repeal it. Okay. Okay, success. 50 million Americans have no health coverage at all. 29 million are underinsured. That's the official underinsured. How many of you have health insurance in the room? If you have your hand up, you're underinsured. Okay. No one is actually safe from being completely financially destroyed by a healthcare crisis in this country, whether you're insured or not, unless you're the 1% and are truly financially independent, separate from the need for health insurance. Employer health insurance coverage is plummeting, now down to 44.5% of Americans. The stats are all over the place, but I think what appears to be true is about 30% of employers are likely to drop their current health insurance altogether in 2014 when the Affordable Health Act gets put in place. Premiums have jumped 50% on average over the last 7 years. In 6 out of 10 states, that means that the average person pays more than a fifth of their income towards healthcare insurance premiums. 30 million Americans were contacted by collection agencies because of medical bills. Okay. Anybody notice the news about Rahm weighing in on what's happening with Minnesota and Accretive Health? Just you should look at this. It's an agency that part of it is about collections in healthcare that have been embedding themselves in the Fairview healthcare system in Minnesota in order to essentially strong arm people, demand that they give their credit cards up front, scare them out of the emergency room if they're unable to pay, but basically actively denying care in the emergency rooms. And they are now facing serious charges in Minnesota. And Rahm actually weighed in to attack I guess she's the attorney general, what state's attorney, whatever she is, the woman who is actually holding the task. He actually weighed in because Accretive is a Chicago-based company that actually gets tax breaks in the state of Illinois, and talked about how they're so helpful, in helping people to obtain health care. 16% jump in the last couple of years in the number of Americans who head to emergency rooms for routine dental care. Okay, has anybody ever had a really bad toothache? Right? You can't think, you can't eat, you can't sleep. Right? You eventually make it to the emergency room. That's the 16% jump that we're talking about there. And then obviously when you look at the U.S. compared to other countries, everyone's heard these stats, but we're the 41st in the world in death rates for childbearing women. And what that means concretely is that the average mortality rate, okay, after birth, so within 42 days of giving birth, the mortality rate, you're more likely as a mother, a new mother, to die. You're twice as likely to die after childbirth as you were 2 decades ago in the United States. And what we see at the bedside, day in and day out, and some of it you almost get, it almost starts to feel normal, right? That's what's really scary when you're in healthcare, is it starts to feel normal. All the time we see senior citizens come in who are taking their medication one day, skipping 2 days, taking it on the fourth day, right? Once in every 3 days, because that's all they can afford because of the premium, because of the cost of their copayments for health insurance. I'm a cancer nurse, right? We see patients all the time who literally will die as they show up at the hospital, will die because they were unable to seek care earlier. And one of the things, I used to work the swing shift, basically from 3 p.m. to 11:30 p.m., so when people are sort of settling down and guests have gone home and people are soul-searching and alone for the first time in the day, it was completely routine. I think probably every single oncology patient with a serious diagnosis at some point says to you on the swing shift, once their family goes home, I don't know, I'm really not sure that my family wouldn't be better off if I were to die sooner rather than letting this drag on because the bills are piling up. That is a constant concern. When you get sick in this country, finances are the first and most immediate thing that has to be on your mind in terms of what to worry about. And it's outrageous, and it's not true in other countries. So obviously, we need a single-payer healthcare system. Single-payer healthcare is a talk all into itself, and I'm running out of time already. But I do want to say a couple things about the Affordable Care Act, which I do not believe is worth defending. I don't care whether the attacks on it come from the left or the right. We should not be defending the Affordable Care Act. I believe it's in the way. I believe that it is a placebo, essentially, that landed on the scene in a moment where we could have won single-payer healthcare. Talk about the Affordable Care Act, typically you have to do a disclaimer that says, yes, well, there are a couple good things. Kids can stay in their parents' health care insurance until they're 26, right? All right, 39 years between 26 and when your health care kicks in at age 65 when you get Medicare. We're supposed to be excited about that? That's if your parents had insurance in the first place that you were on, right? Do immigrants deserve health care? Apparently not, right? You could be a progressive Democrat and be out there, you know, completely formally saying that you don't believe immigrants have a right to health care. Can't deny children health care coverage based on pre-existing conditions. So what are the insurance companies doing? Dropping their child coverage altogether, right? Can't deny adults coverage based on pre-existing conditions. That's okay. We'll just price them out of the market, make it so expensive that you can't possibly get the health care. And obviously, abortion rights are more under threat right now than they've been at any time since Roe v. Wade. And there's an incentive built into healthcare reform to encourage insurance companies to drop abortion coverage. I think, though, when you talk about healthcare, if you just limit yourself to that, you're actually looking small picture, not big picture, because in reality, things have gotten so bad in this country that health insurance is not top of the list in terms of things that people are worried about. And that's becoming more and more true. What makes me unable to sleep at night when I think about it, is the thought of what's happening in terms of poverty, and in particular, child hunger, I think is a great way to kind of capture what that actually is. So, you know, federal poverty level, $22,000 for a family of four. Okay, imagine that first, right? Family of four, $22,000. 25% of children in the U.S. are under that line. And 25% of children in the U.S. deal day-to-day with food insecurity. Right? They don't know where their next meal is coming from. Right? They hope they're going to have it. They're eating a little bit of Wonder Bread. Right? And they are often the best off in their family in terms of, you know, you prioritize your children in your family when you don't have food to eat. Parents are making decisions between food and rent, right? Making impossible decisions. And the economic crisis is obviously, causing us to just downward spiral more and more. Now, to add insult to injury, and this is in some ways really the gist of what I want to get across, to add insult to injury, Most Americans who are suffering under these conditions have lost their house, who have lost who've lost their job, who don't have health care, right, who can't feed their kids, whatever it is, most Americans believe that they have done something wrong, personally done something wrong, to get in that situation. Because that's the take-home message in the United States, is if you worked hard enough, right, you'd be fine. If you had a good work ethic, you'd be fine. So if you're suffering, it means you have done something wrong yourself. And so people suffer in silence. They don't talk to each other about it. They hide it from their friends, right? Kids beg for food from each other in the lunchroom, but don't talk to each other about the fact that their father or mother have lost a job or that they're living in a temporary housing situation, right? People are ashamed of something that has nothing to do with them and everything to do with the system and everything to do with the 1%. And if that weren't bad enough, additionally, we're attacking each other, right? They've actually convinced us, right, that if you're insecure as an individual, right, that other people who are suffering are an active threat to you, right? Or people who have a pension, right? Or people who have health care, or people who have decent wages or the sort of job that you want, that somehow they're a threat to you because there's such a limited pie that we have to stab each other with our fork, right, in order to make sure we get what we need. This country is not broke.
Right.
This country is at its richest point. We're at the richest point in the richest country in world history. And we don't provide for our own. And we try, and they've tried to convince us, right, that it's the person who has that is the cause of you if you have not. The labor movement, unfortunately, has taken a, and I'm National Nurses United, right, part of the labor movement. There needs to be a substantial shift in the way that the labor movement approaches this question, because the labor movement has been trying to plea bargain their way out of this crisis, and thankfully, the Occupy movement came on the scene to show how it should be done. The labor movement polls, puts out a Gallup poll to find out what's popular and what's possible, and concludes that the U.S. citizens don't support collective bargaining, right? So they don't fight back when Scott Walker attacks the unions directly in Wisconsin, right? When they do fight back, they fight back by conceding everything up front, right? We're fine. Take our pensions, our health care, our wages. That's fine. Because really we think this is about union busting, right? That's a polling strategy, right, based on despair about where the country currently is. Polling reflects what has come before, what has happened up until now. It does not reflect what is possible if we fight back. The labor movement has also put itself in the role, because they're plea bargaining. What I mean by that is essentially, we're willing to, you know, let's be pragmatic, right? They want to come after us, so we're going to give them part of what they want, right, in order to try to preserve something. That's the approach. But that means that labor unions all too often turn to their own members who are saying, it's not my fault, I'm under attack. They turn to their own members and say, well, you know, shared sacrifice. We all have to dig a little deeper, don't we? You know, right? Be realistic. They actually sell the plea bargain to their own members who are ready to fight back. And that's completely unacceptable. I have way more than I have time for.
We have about 5 minutes.
Okay, good. Okay. Additionally, one of the things that's faced by the labor movement that we have to change our perspective on is we were in the situation as nurses, being in Wisconsin and arguing with different labor locals, essentially, why they should have faith in the ability of protest to actually turn the thing around and not make concessions in their contracts to try to get ahead of Scott Walker's bill. So they were trying to control the concessions by giving some of them up front rather than having them imposed, right? And we're having these arguments with them about why that's self-defeating proposition. And what they said to us over and over again was, as rank-and-file members would stand up and say, yeah, but when I walk out to my mailbox to get my mail and I see my neighbor who I've been friends with for 20 years, they say to me, who do you think you are that you think you deserve a pension? Right? they spit at me because I'm a public sector worker, whereas I used to be seen as somebody serving the public. Suddenly I'm enemy number one, right? And instead of taking that on, unions have done this plea bargain approach. And so the turn that we have to make is, this is essential, we have to make the argument that I as a nurse, right, if I'm a teacher, if I'm a public sector worker, if I'm a union worker in general, and I'm under attack and I'm fighting for my pension or my health care, I have to say to people, I'm fighting for my pension and my health care because everyone deserves to have one. I'm fighting because I'm in a union, lucky enough to be in a union, and that means I'm better positioned than almost anyone to be at the forefront of this fight.
That's right.
Right? When I fight for myself, I'm fighting for you. I'm fighting because I don't believe that making a concession here moves things forward. I believe it moves it backwards. Somebody has to stand up, and I guess it's going to be us. Okay, I have to segue to the rally somehow. Okay, actually, I have a good way to segue. Speaking of plea bargain, there was some legal advice given to National Nurses United this week. Okay, when Rahm Emanuel and the city decided to withdraw our permit to demonstrate at Daily Plaza, right? Because we're a national security threat. 2,000 nurses and Tom Morello with an acoustic guitar. NATO's in town, but right? Okay. There was some legal advice given to us that we shouldn't go to the press, that we shouldn't do a press conference, that might poison the well or anger the city. Okay. We won that permit back, right, by virtue of calling them out on it. We said Rahm Emanuel is a lobbyist on behalf of financial industry in favor of high-frequency trading and automatic trading, which brings volatility to our stock market, which is a big cause of the crisis in the first place and how we got into this mess in the first place. And the Robinhood tax, or financial transaction tax, that we're fighting for at that rally that nurses from around the world are coming together to talk about and elevate, directly threatens what Rahm cares about and what the financial industry cares about. That's where the threat is. Not a threat to national security, a threat to Wall Street, and that's why they denied our permit. But we turn it around with your support and actually were able to win that permit back. So we hope that you will join us on May 18th, on Friday, May 18th, at noon in Daily Plaza to celebrate that victory. We did a demonstration on Wall Street in June of last year, kind of in response to Wisconsin, because there was so much pro-concession talk, we felt like we needed to point the blame where it belonged. So we went to Wall Street and brought 2,000 nurses there and did it. And around the world, activists around the financial transaction tax and fighters against poverty and the union movement watched the live stream from that video and have talked to us about being in tears watching it. Because the U.S. has been asleep for so long,
yeah.
Right? Just to see the stirring of the Occupy movement, of that, just to see it inspires the world, right? And so this is our time to be on the world stage in Chicago, with the world watching what's possible, and actually point out who the problem is, Wall Street, right? Actively argue against austerity measures and cuts, right? Demonstrate what's possible and be in the belly of the beast, right? Let's take that beast apart from the inside out, from the belly of the beast, okay? So please join us on Friday, May 18th. Let's have a giant round of applause for our amazing panel.